This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Everyone's familiar with the expression six and one half. No, six and one, right? Six and one.
Yeah.
A half dozen in the other.
Yeah.
Yanni just has truncated it. He's shortened it to where when there's a thing, where there's a decision to make and you know, going left and going right, there's no difference. He'll say it's just sixes.
Huh. But I can't take credit for that.
Oh, you can't?
No.
I thought you invented that.
No.
The reason I bring it up is we have a full house right now, so I feel like you should do some intros.
Oh, I'm going to introduce everybody quickly. Yeah. That's a good idea.
That's a good segue.
Yeah, I think with the a lot of times when you do the introductions, it takes way too long. But as you like to do, dealing cards, I'll start off to my left with Mr. Jon Snow, who now is the, let me get it right, shooting editor for both Outdoor Life and Field and Stream.
That's a lot of shooting.
Nailed it.
That's correct.
A lot of guns.
From Bozeman. John Edwards, owner of Schnee's, Bozeman as well. Mr. Steven Ranella. Pete Munich, the sales manager from Stone Glacier.
You got it.
Is that what you do down there?
I do.
You wear a lot of hats, so I feel like they got to give you a bigger business card.
Just hand out full pieces of paper.
Yeah, just 8.5 by 11.
Just hand out resumes as I travel around.
And Philip Larson, and I don't know your title at Black Gold Archery, but it is.
Well, right now I'm doing the design work, but I've been there for 15 years, so I've also wore quite a few hats over the years. I've
done. Yeah, when we go visit,
you do design work.
Mm-hmm. That's all I do.
Rattle off what you guys make down there. Tight spot.
Quivers. Quivers. We do ripcord arrow rests and then black gold bow sights. And so if you've seen a black gold product from any of those companies in the last 10 years, I drew it.
I have none of that shit on my bow. Isn't that weird?
I do, man. It's awesome.
Here you sit, and here's my, you know. I'm going to take my new rig over, though, and we're going to go over it.
Yeah. We'll have to change that.
You did help me get souped up, though.
Mm-hmm. Made sure everything was ready to go.
I'm
going to
come down and accessorize, though, man.
Yeah, we can do that.
I'm going to make an accessorizing appointment.
My father will be so happy now. He can't stand listening when he doesn't know who's talking. This will be a much better experience for
him. I like it because it builds tension when you can't tell who's talking.
Very suspenseful.
Did you guys, I don't know if you guys caught this. This is good. Where, so a dude in Florida is fishing near Clearwater, and an animal rights activist who is apparently coming from a protest at a fast food restaurant. So he's like, him and his boy are leaving a fast food restaurant protest.
Fired up.
Right? So he's jacked up. And he stumbles across some dude on a pier who's fishing. He's got a tilapia. So the dude's got a tilapia, like, laid out on the pier. And, which is funny because it's like he's got like a non-native, like a deleterious exotic, right? Like a non-native fish laid out on the pier.
I thought you got that at Costco.
And this dude, the animal rights guy, freaks out and grabs the fish and hucks it back in the water. And this is, I'm going to make a shirt that says this, because the animal rights guy throws the tilapia in the water and yells, according to bystanders, he yells, "Call the police! I just saved a fish's life!" And the cop comes out and arrests him and fines him $500. For fish throwing the dude's thing back.
It's probably already dead, too.
Yeah, he wasn't doing keeping wet. If it sounds like he had it laid out.
It's laying on the pier for an hour.
On the pier. My buddy Nephi wrote in with this. This is interesting. We're just doing a little, if you boys aren't familiar, we're just doing a little recap. News recap.
Mm-hmm.
Things that Muggs write in about. People getting all mad about stuff we said that wasn't correct. Hunters, right? Especially these days, are always yakking up the significance of our contributions to the Wildlife Restoration Program, Pittman Robertson Fund. My buddy Nephi writes in, and this is some older numbers, but no one ever compiled them before. Like I said, like hunters are always like, oh, hunters do all this good, you know, through excise taxes charged on firearms and ammunition, the money that goes to wildlife. So I should back up. When you buy archery equipment, you buy firearms, you buy ammunition, assorted other things, even boat gas, right? In some marine boat gas. there are excise taxes that you pay. And these excise taxes go to wildlife restoration programs. So they pay for wildlife. And it's been, you know, these programs have been funding wildlife for 80 years to the tunes of billions of dollars. The Pittman Robertson Fund is the one that comes from ammunition and firearms. And of the money that comes in of firearm sales dollars, so the excise taxes on firearms, only 20% can be assigned to hunting purposes.
Wow.
80% are from non-hunting shooters.
That's a lot of shooting.
80%. So it should be like the little old ladies who have a pistol for personal protection should be like, Pittman Robertson, bro. But it's like hunters are talking about all the time. Only 20% comes from hunters.
Wow. That's right. And there's a big tension there between hunters and shooters, because if you read the act, you know, we talk about it going to wildlife, but it specifically says in there for also shooting range development. And this has been a burr under the saddle of a lot of shooters over the years who feel like that they're not getting their fair shake in that equation. And they've actually got a really, really good point.
Yeah, they have a good point. I understand it. It's like one of those things, you know, those situations you're in where there's like right and wrong and then what you hope, right? So there's like right and wrong. Be like, oh, yeah, you look at that. Like you look at those numbers. Well, just to follow up on that. So that was firearms. Ammunition, 26.6% hunting purposes, 73.4 for non-hunting purposes. So a little bit of a slightly different, but basically the same thing. In terms of like what's right and wrong and then your hopes, it's like, yeah, you look at the right and wrongness, they should have a big seat at the table. Shooters, right? Around shooting facilities, whatnot. But dude, I hate to like I hate to starve the wildlife funds, right?
Yeah, no, you don't want to do that. But I think this is part of a bigger conversation about where
this
our world
Snow
is going.
Talking.
You know, because hunters need shooters for exactly this reason. You know, the shooters are the ones who are carrying the freight to help us pay for these conservation programs. You know, likewise, I think shooters need hunters in terms of just the general issue over gun rights and gun access and everything else. I think hunters play a key role in that. But it's this dynamic where sometimes these two populations are squaring off against each other. And I think a slightly deeper look shows that there's really a mutually necessary kind of relationship that needs to be fostered. But from the shooter standpoint, you know, we as hunters, I'm also a shooter, but have to maybe give them a little bit more of a place at the table and give those issues. Because if people don't have places to shoot, they ain't going to hunt either.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a symbiotic relationship for sure, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the Pittman-Robertson Act was originally enacted for the purpose of restoring wildlife.
Wildlife Restoration Act.
It is, but you read the language. It says shooting range development right in it, in the original act.
Franklin Roosevelt, that original act. Like from the Roosevelt administration.
Absolutely.
I was going to say is it's not static. I mean, it could very well be that we need some new legislation or something to address some of the needs of the shooting community that are not necessarily hunting. No,
it's already in there. I mean, the thing is that, and you know, you kind of think about it. How many hunters do you know? Oh, I'm on the same box of Remington Corlocks I've been using for 5 years.
It's like you buy 20 shells and it's like, this is good for 10 years. One to check my zero and right. One to hunt.
thanks for pulling on the oars, buddy. We appreciate your support, as opposed to the guy who's buying, ammo cans of 223 every other week and just, you know, hosing down steel at the target. That's the guy who's financially contributing.
It was a shock to me when I read it this morning. I knew, like, if you'd have had me lay it out, I wouldn't have laid it out at that. I would have laid it out at like, I wouldn't have gone 50-50, but I wouldn't have gone 80-20. I would have been somewhere in the, I'd have been, I don't know, 60-40.
Right. So you're saying for every dollar I spend as a hunter, there's four other dollars being spent by target shooters?
Yeah,
by shooters.
Every dollar of yours that winds up into the Wildlife Restoration Fund, shooters.
Shooters, so recreational shooters, average, target shooters, defensive handgun,
What's the data on the overlap there? Because yeah, here in Montana,
you're two.
I'm looking at Matt Miller, and we, you know, we just joined this awesome new shooting facility in Three Forks, Montana, that Glenn Demaray is running. But there's got to be a tremendous overlap between shooters and hunters, at least out west. Oh,
especially in Montana.
Well, I think that they're trying to pull out. Like, of course, there's different people. I think they're kind of pulling out like what the purpose was for. So, okay, so ammunition and firearms combined. Here's the real, okay, so I was giving you the numbers where they're separated out, but Nephi also sent the numbers for combined. Combined, 22.5% can be assigned to hunting purposes, and the remainder, 77.5% to non-hunting purposes. They were not, it was not possible to, here's interesting, it was not possible to assess archery sales. Lord knows how they do this. I'll get clarity. I'll get some clarification, and I'll try to explain how the NSSF pulled up these figures. I'm doing something with the NSSF right now around their child safe storage program, which we're going to be launching pretty soon. We were talking about trail cams and how for a while, we're talking about trail cams and my feeling that even though I use them, my feeling that at some point we're going to wind up needing to have like a reckoning with trail cameras, the way, same way we had to have a reckoning with drones, right? Is if it's going to be that like in the not so distant future, you're going to have all these live feed trail cameras, and basically you, the temptation would be just like to hunt off live. Like you could be out in the woods turkey hunting with, and you got you know, a dozen live feed cameras going, and you just kind of scroll through and find out where you ought to walk over and, you know, set up, which is not, I mean, that's not far off at all. You could basically do it right now.
Yeah, that completely exists right now.
Yeah, and my thing that like, not even, forget me advocating on it, my prediction that state agencies are going to take steps to get out ahead of this. And a lot of guys wrote in to clarify that in Nevada, on public land, we'll get a bunch of notes about how I just said that word. In Nevada, on public land, no trail cams August 1st to December 31st. And Montana was doing the same thing and quit doing it.
Just changed.
Yep.
They changed it back again?
No, it just became legal during the hunting season.
Then it became illegal. Then it became legal again. I'd love to know that thinking.
Yeah, they're all over the map. I mean, it was as long as I've been here, not legal to have cameras up during hunting season.
And now it is.
Just became.
But I remember when it became ill.
You were here before I was.
Yeah. Another thing, we were talking about scent blockers. This is when we had Mark Kenyon from Wired to Hunt, who's a frequent guest. Scent blocker stuff, right? Deer stuff. You spray on yourself so you don't smell to deer. And okay, this is two things we were talking about. We're talking about scent blockers, and then we were talking about how good dogs can smell and like what dogs smell and how dogs' noses work. So this is kind of a combo deal. Where another guy who works in canine units wrote in, and he was saying when all the scent blocker shit came out, all these sprays and all this, in the canine world, in the law enforcement canine world, they started to get very concerned about what would be the implications of these products on their ability to pursue suspects, detect drugs. Oh, you know what I was watching there tonight? Just quick side note. Have you guys seen Mike Judge's Tales from the Tour Bus? Dude, it is the greatest
series. Sounds good.
It's an animated series of all the outlaw country people.
We got to get Pete on that.
Waylon Jennings part one. Dude, it's like by the guy, Mike Judge. Dude, like Family Guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they got like, it's on Cinemax. You can buy it on iTunes. It's a Cinemax original, but I've been buying it on iTunes. And it's like, so it's Tammy Wynette and George Jones part one and two. Johnny Paycheck part one, and it's mostly about just the amount of drugs and gunplay that went on in that world. And then Waylon Jennings part one and two, every episode it's just the crazy shit that those guys are up to. But in it, they're talking about one time they're going into Canada, and Willie Nelson was so concerned about his tour bus that they stopped and had it steam cleaned and like ultra cleaned.
Wow.
To get into Canada. And he said, the guy says when the drug dog comes onto Willie Nelson's bus, it doesn't like smell around. It just comes and sits down. So it wasn't like where on the bus. It was the bus.
It's the whole damn vehicle.
So that leads me to the canine thing. So he said they got real concerned about this. And he was saying they mixed results, okay? So with scent blockers, the dogs always still found the items or persons when using scent blockers marketed to whitetail deer hunters. And the time, but the time was kind of minuscule. He remembers one example with a dog trying to find a person. The dog normally could find the person in 8 to 10 second time range. He calls this minuscule. It's normally 8 to 10 second time range, but with scent blockers, it took one dog 40 seconds to find the person. Now, if you're bow hunting, dude, that is an eternity.
Yep.
From 10 to 40 is, that would have for me meant a shot this year at a very nice buck a week ago. But he goes to say, some dogs showed zero effect. Some dogs' time was not affected. Here's the other funny part. Once you expose a dog to the scent blocker, there was zero impairment. They learned to deal with it very quickly. They did determine, some agencies determine that the product confuses some dogs with their ability to seek out the location of the scent. So they know it's there, but locating it becomes different. Now, scent covers, where you're adding other highly potent scents or you infuse items in natural scents that animals are used to, are more effective at disturbing a dog's ability, more effective than scent blockers, but it does not stop the dog from doing their search. He spoke with a guy in from the province of Alberta, and he spoke with a woman from the province of Alberta, and they've been looking at this too, with all the different dog handlers and all the different agencies, and they determined that scent blockers pose zero risk when their dogs are searching. As new products come out, they always test them on dogs. And a dog's nose isn't a deer's nose, but it still is kind of interesting, right? The woman from Alberta, who's a canine trainer, she pointed out that she's also an avid hunter. And from her look at it, she thinks that the worst thing you can do is wear a scent blocker because they're so popular. In her opinion, if deer do in fact become educated with sounds and seeing humans as a threat, she feels that deer are more likely to associate that very powerful smell with humans through exposure, just like how dogs do.
The blocker or the cover?
Blockers.
Because I didn't think the blocker was supposed to smell like anything. I thought the scent cover.
Okay, whatever one, I might have mixed it up somewhere. Whatever one is where you're doing added odors.
Yeah, you're acting like a pine tree or something. Yeah.
I've always been suspicious of those things ever since. This was years ago when ScentLock was first coming out and they made a big push. Because I don't think that those guys even believe in their products.
Yeah, I can't speak to them.
Well, here's what
happened. You mean the outfits that you put on?
The charcoal outfits?
Yeah,
the charcoal outfit. So anyway, this was this big thing, new tech, going to go try this out. Isn't this fascinating? Deer can't smell you. So anyway, they invite me on this hunt down to Texas. And it's a classic Texas hunt where I'm in a blind and some mesquite patch with a shooting lane cut down it and a damn feeder 100 yards away.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there with the guy.
Don't make this a dog. Listen, can I interrupt?
Sure.
Turn it into a really nice thing about Texas. Because I've been getting a lot of emails from a lot of Texans who are like, you guys have no clue what you're talking about. And you're taking this enormous state and where you got like guys hunting Sam Houston National Forest and knocking it out and like hunting public land and busting their asses. And you got guys out in the West Texas busting their asses. And all we're ever talking about is some dude in Texas in a 300 acre fenced area with corn. And they're like, shut up.
Yeah. Well,
you don't know Texas.
I will sing the praises of West Texas any day.
Texas too.
It's great. It's great hunting West Texas. And the rest of it, at least in my experience. So anyway,
I'm going to start like a moratorium on dogging on Texas because I would like to read it, but it was like a book length piece where a guy broke Texas into a bunch of regions and explained the hunting cultures in each region. And we have been doing a horrible job of pigeonholing Texas. Go on.
Okay. So I was in an undisclosed location with a lot of mesquite and a deer feeder. And sitting next to me is this.
Sounds like Texas.
The ScentLock guy who I was with is smoking cigarettes in the blind next to me. And I was just like, yeah, okay. I think I know everything I need to know now about ScentLock.
You sure wasn't rolled alfalfa? It was like an alfalfa joint.
I'm pretty sure. So I've never been a, and also I'm just lazy. I don't have time to do all that scent
stuff. But didn't Scent Block, what was the clothes with the charcoal in it?
That was Scent Lock. Scent Lock.
Didn't they have a bit of a, like an expose? Wasn't there like a kind of a, like an actual expose about Scent Lock? Well, does this ring a bell?
The thing is they have, there was also Dead Down Range. Remember that? The, like the breath mints that are supposed to like, I mean, I'm not saying this stuff is all snake oil because I don't think they actually make it out of snakes. But, you know, I don't know. I've just never quite wrapped my head around that because I've done scent work with dogs before and it's amazing what they can pick up. And the idea that we're somehow shielding off all this stink that we throw
well,
off.
Well, and the industry is always looking for a silver bullet. And a lot of the guys that I know who are very successful hunters are just hard hunters. You know, it's like, what's the next gadget? What's the next thing? What's the, you know, what's going to make me a better, oh, now I got this gum I can chew now, you know, or the scent block or Ozonics or anything like that.
A lot of the old timers used to believe in campfire smoke.
Right? Yeah. As a cover scent.
You know, as a cover scent.
The thing I've always wondered about is just the confidence factor. So a guy goes out there with the new gizmo and all of a sudden now he's more confident. Does that
help?
For
the
sure.
Mark, the Mark Kenyon Wired to Hunt approach, which I appreciate, is he's like, I don't know. but let's say I do all of these things, which aren't that big of a deal. They're not that hard for me to do. I do them all. And let's say one of them gives me 10% better chance. I'll take it. Because the things I'm doing, I know aren't negative.
Or if each one is gives me 1% better, and then they add up.
And that's what he talks about. He's like, here this guy is saying, oh, it's minuscule, 10 seconds, 40 seconds. Mark's like, maybe it gives me a second. Maybe it buys me a second. Yeah, it's not that big. It's not hard for me to do these things.
Mm-hmm. But didn't the gal say maybe the deer get used to it, you know, and all of a sudden now it's working against you.
So, yeah, you pass that buck 1 year and next year he's like, oh, nope.
That's the dude who tried to shoot me last year.
He passed me, not this year.
This guy goes on to say, as a side note, his dog, the neighbor's dog. Okay, sorry. As a side note, his neighbor's got a Belgian Malinois. How do you say that, Yanni?
I don't know.
Malamute.
The Belgian Malinois.
Oh, no.
Oh, Malinois. Yeah.
It's this dog is trained in explosives location and suspect apprehension. This dog's so damn good that when he started messing around with a single pin slider for his bow and trying to get out to 100-yard mark, he's losing a fair bit of arrows. He's saying you could take that sumbitch and dog and take another arrow out of your quiver and run that arrow under that dog's nose, and that thing will go find your arrow. Two or three passes, and it's got your arrow.
That's impressive,
man. I wonder if it's smelling the human on it. Speaking of dogs, tell Yanni, we've been covering the McLean.
Yes.
Tree stand stealer heavily.
McLean or
this
McLean.
Is the last we're going to say about the tree stand stealer, but it has to do with dogs, so I want to roll it in. You guys familiar with this?
No.
Big famous.
Andrew McLean from, I think he's in Park City, which is right outside of Salt Lake City. And this guy wrote a book about skiing the, now we're going to get in trouble again. How did the guy pronounce it?
I don't know. I must have seen a half dozen people telling you how to pronounce
Wasatch.
It.
Wasatch.
Wasatch.
Wasatch. I would say Wasatch.
Yeah.
Wasatch.
Wasatch.
Pete, you look Wasatch. Like you're cocky about it.
Yeah, it's the Wasatch front.
Yeah.
So you when you right. need to Anyways. Say it, pause and Pete will say it.
Yep.
Okay.
Just give
you
me
You wrote
a
book about
point.
Skiing the
Wasatch
Mountains. And I wouldn't call him a famous skier, but almost famous. Anyways, he decided to, in his own words, clean up the woods around his house. With a bolt cutter and stole two tree stands and a trail camera, but did not realize that the hunter had a second trail camera in the same location and thus caught Andrew and his wife stealing the stands and packing them out of the woods.
On public land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Totally legally placed thing. Mm-hmm. But the reason I keep talking about this and puts a real burr in my saddle is like there's people in the ski world and stuff who are like applauding him for this.
Yeah. Which is public land, did it legally. It was some hardware in public. I just watched Valley Uprising the other night, and this one guy back in the 70s put a bunch of bolts in Yosemite. And then this other climber that hated him went up the next week and busted every piece of hardware off the wall in an effort to like make a statement that he didn't agree with putting this hardware into nature.
Yep.
So this seems very similar.
Yeah.
One was a tree stand, one were climbing bolts in Yosemite. But I think both legally placed.
Yeah. No, it's like, it pisses me off only because some people are acting like he's like, dude. We even had a guy who like just started hunting. He's like, I understand because hunters leave a lot of litter in the woods. Come on. But go ahead.
No, I thought you were going to finish it.
No, you talked about the dog.
Tell us now how the... Oh, you wanted me to explain the whole story.
Like, yeah, we're talking about dogs. This is like supposed to be a slick a segue.
I know. I thought you were going to tell us that story. So how he ends up finding Andrew and putting the pieces all together is that they had their dog with them when they were doing this forest robbery. And it was a Burmese Mountain Dog?
Burmese Mountain Dog.
Yeah. And he figures, yeah, it's not that many around. I'll sort of cruise the neighborhoods around this trailhead that he most likely used and see if his dog pops up. So he's cruising down the road.
Wow.
Sure enough, there's a dog rolling by himself. No leash, no owner. And he's like, oh, I'll just follow this Burmese Mountain Dog. He follows it down the road a little bit, and he goes right up to the front door.
Gotcha.
And opens the door. There's Andrew's wife. He's like, oh.
I recognize you from my trail camera pictures.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Okay, another area I want to talk about. We were talking about a guy. Do you remember what state it was where the guy served the kangaroo meat?
Nebraska.
A lot of feedback on this. So a dude that runs a hot lunch program in Nebraska. This is a long news segment. Is this the last bit of news? No. Anyhow, a dude like who runs a hot lunch program decides to buy some kangaroo meat and like cut it in with the beef.
Oh, God.
For whatever, like, why ever. He thought it sounded like a good deal. And some kids, I believe there's no way this is true. Some kids claim what they found out, or the kids claim they have felt sick from the kangaroo meat.
Start jumping higher.
In the hot, yeah, everybody, the basketball team started kicking ass.
Basketball team started crushing.
And the dude loses his job. And we were talking about this news bit, and we were wondering about the kangaroo market. And a bunch of Australian guys wrote in, two in particular, wrote in with a lot of information about kangaroo, where kangaroo meat comes from. There is no raising. No one raises kangaroos for meat.
They're all wild?
When you see kangaroo meat on the menu, it's all wild shot.
Wow.
Now, so mug one. I picked, there's two mugs that wrote in about this. Mug one and mug two. Mug one, populations from 2011. In Australia for macropods, which are red kangaroos, western gray kangaroos, eastern gray kangaroos, wallaroos, and euros, whatever the hell that is. Within the commercial harvest areas, there's over 34 million of them, which, and then in the continent at large, 50 million macropods in Australia.
How many Australians are there?
He says greatly outnumbering the human population. Now, Mug 2 is a commercial shooter.
Sweet.
Can I interrupt?
Please.
We know a few kind of pro hunters from Australia. Did any of them hunt kangaroos?
Probably not, because it's highly regulated. Like, the hunting in Australia is generally for non-natives. Right? But this is a highly regulated industry. And this guy goes, here's a commercial shooter. This is a guy that makes his living shooting kangaroos, the kangaroos that wind up in the U.S. for meat. And he goes on to say, for starters, it's not even a popular meat in Australia. However, it's available in regular supermarkets for human consumption, and it is a staple of pet foods. It's very cheap, very healthy, but because it's so lean, it requires careful cooking and has never been more than a niche product here in Australia. He says all the meat in Australia, kangaroo meat, is all sourced from wild kangaroos shot by professionals. He says that it is probably, give the guy the credit, he's saying probably the last industrial scale market hunting in the world. They export to many countries, including the U.S., and he has been unable to find anyone raising them domestically for meat over there or here. So wild kangaroo is almost certainly what the kids in Nebraska were eating. He says the industry here is regulated in all states with strict kill quotas, licensing of shooters, and carcass handling requirements. Here's where it gets interesting. Like, all the shooting is done at night with spotlights. And by law, all animals must be killed with a shot to the head from a centerfire rifle of at least .222 caliber. Most guys are using a .223. Almost all the shooting is done on private land, requiring the permission of the landholder. Generally, it's farmland where kangaroos are doing crop damage. Most shooters work alone in a single four-wheel drive vehicle using a roof-mounted spotlight and a shooting rest mounted on the truck door. You shoot from a seated position. You shoot them, you field dress them, you hang them in the back of the truck, and then you drop them off at a chilled processing plant at the end of the night. He normally takes around 30 per night, each weighing 50 to 100 pounds. He says, interestingly, almost all kangaroos shot commercially are males, and the major processors will only accept male carcasses. It's not legal. It's just done for PR reasons because the females are almost always pregnant, almost always have a baby in the pouch. The shooter is legally required to humanely kill the joey when he does shoot a female. He goes into details about how they get this done, which I'll not share. I'll share it over a glass. I don't drink anymore, so I'll share it over a glass of water. But it doesn't look good for the industry. He has not found any evidence of changes to population dynamics due to this sex-specific harvest. How would it not? You're only killing males. If you're not shooting females, no wonder there's still 50 million of them. Out of that population of 50 million, they're harvesting right now about 5 to 7 million annually. He also says, he goes on to say this, in addition to the commercial harvest, kangaroos can be shot privately to mitigate agricultural damage by landowners and recreational shooters with landowner permissions. Laws vary state to state, with some states requiring a landowner to apply for tags, and they allow the use of the carcass. However, in my home state, it is open season. There's no season, no bag limit, no weapons restrictions, which sounds amazing, but unfortunately, it is illegal to keep the carcasses or to use any of the meat, even for personal consumption. Meaning, you can shoot them, can't eat them, which I don't even get. And he says, as a result of this, and from our extremely restrictive firearm laws, we have no culture of recreational kangaroo hunting. He also goes on to say this about Australia. He says we should be seen as a cautionary tale for the rest of the world, in particular the USA. We have a vast amount of wilderness. WA, where he is larger than Alaska and Texas combined. Huge areas of undeveloped public land, but no legal recreational hunting allowed on any of it. Even on private land, hunting is extremely restricted, limited to a few feral species, and our restrictions on firearm access make this even inaccessible to most people. That's what he's got to say about all that.
Sad story.
Now, mug number two, insisting with talking about some loosening of restrictions, where now a landowner with a problem can designate shooters, and he's going out this weekend. And you can designate shooters, and they loosen the restrictions on using the meat, and he's going out this weekend. They're hoping to put 10 in the freezer. He says this is great news for those of us living in New South Wales. He says he likes to... the tails can be used as you would oxtail. They like the back straps and the tenderloins. And they like to mince the hind legs and cut in some beef fat for burgers, etc. Anyone got anything to say about that? That's a deep dive right there, boys, on kangaroo hunting. I'll be not returning to that subject anytime soon.
I'd like to try it.
I've eaten it.
Have you had it?
What is it comparable to?
Stringy-ass meat. Like stringy antelope meat, I guess. I remember, like, you when I got it, I had some kangaroo back. I had some kangaroo, like, little T-bones. Huh, what's it called where you got, like, your rib? What do they call that? Beef cutting?
Rib chop?
Yeah, chop. Yeah. That's what I'm looking for.
They cut the whole thing and they got the part of the back.
Yeah, little handle. Yep. Yeah, we used to have a bandsaw and we'd cut deer and antelope that way, like little chops. Mm-hmm. It was like eating that, but you needed to go floss your teeth when you got done.
I had no idea there were so many different types of kangaroos.
Dude, I didn't either.
The Kangaslam.
We get a lot of emails from guys in Australia because there's not like a robust, there's a lot of hunters, but there's not a sort of a culture and information, you know. There's not like a conversation around hunting as much as what a lot of them point out. So they're kind of like, we hear from Australians who like that there'd be, that there's this thing that's accessible to them where people are like talking about all this stuff, right? Get a lot of notes from them.
So you're saying there's parts of Australia where they can shoot them, but they can't touch them.
I'd always heard that. He says they're loosening those restrictions up. And it's part of broader stuff because the same thing is like in Australia, you have all these non-natives.
Right.
And there's some guys that do some amount of hunting. And there's a lot of people like, we would love to go do some hunting. Can you loosen the restrictions? And the government's like, no, we'd rather pay people to shoot them out of helicopters and leave them to rot rather than let you redneck hicks go out and shoot them and eat them.
Yeah.
We'd rather like cripple them up from a helicopter and let them die a slow death. And, you know, and then, like I said, they got these really draconian gun laws there, which make it like extremely difficult. So, but there's like a, I think there's a growing population of bow hunters just to get around the, you know, just the weapons deal. Everybody good on that?
Opens a whole can of worms about gun rights.
Oh, that's what he says about the cautionary tale. Speaking of cautionary tales, Yanni, can I hit one more?
Sure. We're only half an hour in.
Oh. This isn't even a news one. A couple questions came in. Guy was saying, like, you know, hunters will, like, you shoot a buck, right? And you get to talking about, oh, you know, the North American model of wildlife conservation and fueling and feeding my family and all the great stuff we do for wildlife. This guy says, okay, I know all this, how great it is that you all hunt and how great it is that the animals are there and they're giving their lives for you and how happy the animals should be about all this whole system you guys have created. He says, picture that we're in a Cormac McCarthy-esque postmodern dystopia. Cannibals out looking for sustenance to survive, right? Just like you and you shooting your bucks. And these cannibals come up and they kill you and your family and eat you. Do you feel real honored about having continued the lives of your fellow humans?
Jeez.
That's a good question. I'd be bummed.
But I don't think
I'd be bummed.
Do we ever say that the animal somehow is feeling honored itself?
No.
No.
But I was talking to an animal rights philosopher. He's in the documentary that we did, which will be available soon. But the animal rights philosopher is like, you get like hunters, like talk all this talk about this honorific, right? This honorific relationship with the animals, and the animal doesn't care about your motivations. You're causing it pain and killing it. It's just all in your own head to make you feel better about something that's awful, and don't act like you're doing something with or for this creature. You're just hurting it and killing it, and that's all it knows.
But the animal probably does prefer the advanced or improved habitat that it calls home thanks to $100, or it does.
Good job, Pete.
Yeah.
That's slick. Keep going.
Yeah, there's other things besides just getting shot in the chest. I mean, you've lived your whole life in this fantastic habitat that maybe was mildly influenced by man, and maybe you appreciate most of that. And yeah, at the end of the day, you got shot and ate by Farmer John. But
well, sometimes you don't know what's coming. I mean, yeah, it's rough out there for critters, you know?
Oh, and mugs.
I mean, at night, they got to try to stay alive.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the alternative? You know, be eaten alive by a predator?
Have a coyote eat your hind quarter off you?
I was gonna leave it to you. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh, but yeah. The ratio, like the percentages of violent death, are extraordinary.
Look, there's no death. There's no death in the natural world that's a pleasant death for these animals. It's exposure. It's starvation. It's disease. It's getting torn asunder by a predator. You know, in a sense, you know, on that scale, what a hunter does is the most merciful of all of them. But the problem I have with that philosopher's question is that he's talking about the individual. And really, when we look at this, we're not dealing with an individual animal. We're dealing with an ecosystem, you know, and our, you know, the saving grace of what hunters are doing is we're preserving and maintaining an ecosystem. And within that, yeah, we're killing individual animals, but they're not discrete individuals the way people are. So I don't think that the analogy holds up.
Yeah, I think their philosophy is that it's anthropomorphism, right? They believe that an individual animal sort of has some sort of feelings.
Yeah. That's the thing I always try to focus on top about when I come up with questions like that, which are totally fair questions. But I always point out like hunters tend to be like hunters who are involved in the conservation movement tend to be focused on like deer nests. sort of like the entire package of like the deer population in general, right? And not so focused on an individual. I was having like a little Instagram battle today, a brief Instagram battle today with the animal rights guy who was pissed at Yanni for having killed a bull. And I was pointing out to him.
You responded to that guy?
Oh, yeah. And I was pointing out to him that in the early 1900s, this state had 5,000 elk. Today, this state has 150,000 elk. That's hunters did that. So if you want to have a who does more for wildlife contest, as far as I could tell, this guy is some kind of sound mixer or something. He's like the internet troll slash sound mixer. Like, if you want to have a who does most for wildlife tournament between you and the eagle's going to smoke you. I was telling him.
You know, I am a little fascinated by this Cormac McCarthy kind of world, though, where it's regulated cannibalism. You know, I mean, are they getting licenses? Do they have to wear Hunter Orange?
It's not, not regulated.
McCarthy's work. You want to see a good segue? Then I got only one more thing. No, two more things. Sorry. Good song recommendation. We did a show recommendation, which is Tales from the Tour Bus. There's a song right now that I've been listening to a fair bit by a band called The Quiet Hollers. It's called Mont Blanc. And it's I like it because it's McCarthy-esque. It's a dude who you gather is living in a post-apocalyptic situation. Okay, when you listen to it, you keep hearing him say, I shed a tear for the books I should have read. And I thought, without paying any attention, I thought it was like a guy who is bummed out that he didn't pay more attention in school. But he's a dude living in a post-apocalyptic scenario trying to keep his family alive once you listen closely to the lyrics. And what he's saying is, when he says, I shed a tear for the books I could should have read, he's wishing he had been studying up on the kind of shit we tend to talk about here on this digital radio program. That's what he's lamenting. That now here he is in a situation he doesn't know how to function and operate.
It's not an upbeat tune.
No.
Those are some of the best tunes.
And, he goes, and then the bomb. But you can't tell what he's saying. I had to go look it up online. He's talking about his life, you know, and he's like, he should have been paying more attention, but he was snuggled with his old lady. And he's like, and then the bomb. And then he gets into like what life's like after the bomb and how he sheds a tear for the books he should have read. Okay, guy wrote in to ask this. He needs to, I don't want to ask too many questions here. He wants to shoot a deer, but when he does it, he needs it to fall down immediately and not jump a fence. He's going to be shooting from 20 yards. He owns a Remington 1100. He's thinking that that's the way he's going to do this. And he goes, I have heard to use slug, high shoulder, and also number 9 pellets. Any assistance greatly appreciated.
Yikes.
I've got some thoughts.
Yeah. I'll have you give the thoughts. I'm going to start by saying, usually when you're in a situation where you're like, right? Where you need to tee it up.
Preemptively trying to avoid.
Yeah, where you're kind of like, I'm in a dicey situation. But let's just, never mind. I trust that you've got this all sorted out and you know what you got yourself into. Then I'll let the expert speak on that one. Quail shot or a slug?
Well, definitely not the quail shot. And I've personally never used it, but I've heard a lot of people have great success, probably especially at close range like that, with buckshot.
Yeah.
To the head.
But not number 9 birdshot, which is illegal anyway. I know what state he's in, and it's illegal in your state.
Well, so different states have different laws about your critter jumping a fence and crossing a line and whether you can or cannot retrieve that animal, what that looks like. Montana has their own unique definition of that law. Mm-hmm. But depending on what state he's in, could decide what weapon he should be using.
Well, at 20 yards, if he goes with buckshot, he'd be very safe. There's that federal, it's an LE load that has a type of wadding in it that helps keep that together. Even with a regular buckshot at 20 yards, the pattern's going to be tighter than your fist.
And so you're going head or chest with that?
I would go neck. Oh, I'd go right.
Really?
Yeah, with that buckshot, absolutely. Absolutely. The problem that the head... You know, the headshot works great, but the vitals are so small. And if you mess up, you have just done the most horrific thing to an animal.
Oh, then your neighbor's going to be in for a real treat.
Oh, I mean, then you've got zombie deer with no lower jaw.
But buckshot, right? I mean.
Well, no, I'm saying we were talking about buckshot. Buckshot would be fine. A slug would be fine, too.
Yeah.
But trust me, you're not going to want to get hit by either one of them. But buckshot at that range will be tighter than your fist.
How about birdshot?
No.
It's just too small.
I don't want to give his state away, but in his state, birdshot's illegal.
I can't imagine birdshot being legal
anywhere.
So, John, if you had to pick one, though, 20 yards.
20 yards, drop it like it's
not. Or the slug. Or is it going to be neck, buckshot, or high shoulder?
I would go neck, buckshot. That deer is not moving.
I like to think he needs it to fall real fast because he doesn't want to drag it far. Rather than that, he's in some kind of weird neighborly situation.
That changes everything.
My take, and this is just me not really even knowing what I'm talking about. I would feel, if I hadn't just consulted with Jon Snow, I would feel that the slug high shoulder. Because then you're shooting at a pie plate.
Yeah, if we're talking about just anchoring an
animal. I'm talking
about
the base of the neck. I'm not talking center neck. I'm talking base neck, which is kind of that high shoulder area too. But I think, I could be wrong on this, but like there are guys like in Minneapolis who are doing the deer control there. And I think they're using slugs, but they're doing that high neck shot because they don't want anything to run around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because they're doing them in parks, like where people are walking through at night and stuff. So
we have a buddy that does that for a living, and they do head and neck with a 223.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
They shoot for airports. They shoot for municipalities.
Facing away, he said, right? That was the shot they liked.
He likes it to be facing the other direction.
Well, it gives you a lot more target area, usable target area that way.
And he's talking about the kind of shooting where you're looking at a couple people watching TV in the window of the front window of a house, and you're shooting deer in their yard. Like that kind of like very tightly controlled or like high. What am I trying to say?
Surgical.
I have a slightly macabre story about this, where this was in Minneapolis, where a friend of mine got invited on one of these calls, and he didn't, in the moment, he forgot about the shot placement, and he put it through the rib cage like
normal style.
And so this was a snowy park.
Oh, God.
Mm.
And actually, it connected to a cemetery, and the deer, of course, shot through both sides, hosing everywhere.
70 yards
on tombstones, on the whole thing. He said they spent hours trying to clean this up and sanitize.
This is my last one. That Yanni, you got a bunch, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to hit one more. Because this is what I kind of understand. The guy wrote in and he's saying, we've talked about vac sealers. We talked about chamber sealers. You guys clear what we're talking about? You know what a chamber sealer is?
Is that where it goes into like the tub and you close the door on top of it? Yeah.
I have one each. So I have like a Weston vac sealer that's non-chamber, right? And that's where everybody has, right? You open the thing up, lay the bag over the lip. The bag's laying out on the counter.
Sucks it out.
Zap it. A chamber sealer, it goes into a vacuum chamber. And I know you don't need the bag. The bags are cheaper because there you don't need a bag that allows the one-way flow. You don't need a vented bag, right? Because when you're pulling, if you picture a normal sealer, when it's expunging air, right, it can pass through like a one-way pass through the vented bag. On a chamber sealer, the whole chamber's vac, so you can just use a regular heavy-duty bag, and the bags are cheaper. He goes on to say, I would like some input and clarification on what's the best. Then he says that, here's what initiated his problem. He thawed some rabbits. He had some rabbit stock. I like this guy immensely. He had some rabbit stock in his deep freeze in half-gallon jars. He overfilled them and noticed today that three of the jars cracked in the freezer. That's a legit problem, man. Like, because I'll freeze stock. I'll pressure seal it where it can just go into your counter or into your cupboard or pantry. But I also sometimes freeze stock. And yeah, man, you can't fill the jar all the way up. You got to leave a lot of headspace on that thing when you freeze it. So that's one thing. When he goes on to talk about chamber sealing liquids, I don't see any reason. I'm not a physicist. I don't see any reason why you would ever need to vacuum seal a liquid, because a liquid isn't like compressible. Right?
Yeah.
Like what? And liquids don't freeze or burn.
When you vacuum seal an elk steak, though, the goal is not to compress the elk steak. It's to take all the air away around the elk steak, right?
Yeah.
So that would be the same goal with the liquid. Just get all
Let's give
the
guy the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's trying to figure out a way to more efficiently stack stuff in his freezer. Like, you know, I'll sometimes do that with, like, different kinds of sauces.
But you can't vac seal. Chamber sealer or not. When you put into, like, I have a big Weston chamber sealer at my fish shack. And that thing kicks ass all day long. But you can't lay a bag of liquid down in there. Because when you pull the vacuum on it, all that liquid, even if you're doing a piece of fish with a small amount of liquid, the liquid gets pulled out and you got to roll up a piece of paper towel and like lay it down in there to keep the liquid from pulling out and ruining the seal. If you put a bag of stock in a vacuum sealer, all it's going to happen is you're going to have an empty bag and you're going to have a vacuum sealer that holds one quart of stock.
The simple,
it's just going to go like...
Yeah, it'll be a mess. I think the simple answer is just to take a Ziploc freezer bag, fill it with the liquid, and just kind of squeeze the air out as you seal it.
Well, the real answer, that's great, is not use glass, too. Freeze in plastic. And if you're a plastic phobe, freeze in glass, but don't overfill. But then he goes down to this other question where he was wondering about chambers versus regular. I wish I knew like the opposite of a chamber, non-chamber and chamber. He's saying, do chamber sealers do better on cuts with potential sharp bones, such as shanks? Now, that question, there is an interesting question. Because when you're doing, if you use shitty vacuum seal bags and you're vac sealing salmon and you don't pull the pin bones first, you can get your bag can be perforated from the pin bones. Or if you like pre-cut your ossobuco, where you pre-cut your shanks and you got little burrs on the bone, and then you go to vac seal with shitty bags, the shitty bags are more likely to get perforated by the corner of the bone. Which that leads to a problem. So for that, because chamber sealers, you can use a heavier gauge bag. You can buy like really heavy gauge bags. I would go and say, sure. But don't buy bad bags.
The answer to that, though, is you remember what they did down at Quality Meats? I forget the name of it.
Oh, Divine Meat Company?
Yeah, Divine Meat Company. Clayton Saunders. They had a chamber sealer that we did all of our hog in. And they just had little pieces of sort of like robust plastic. Remember?
I forgot about that.
That they would basically put on the tips of the ribs and the sharp edges.
Yeah, man. Was it made for that?
I don't know.
So they would essentially pre-wrap the part that could poke through the bag with like a heavier duty
pack. Or just slip it in there and kind of set it right on the sharp edge.
And so then when they sealed it, it would keep it from poking through.
Yeah, totally forgot about that. You're right. They would, on their bone-in cuts, they would pad it up. But he was chamber sealing too.
He was.
With some nice heavy-duty bags. Potentially heavy-duty bags.
Sounds like all of you guys' discussion about vacuum sealing all comes down to the bag. It's like, good bag, just...
I think there's
the best bag you can, because if you don't, you're just going to ruin the meat.
I used to have so many more problems with them, but I have a lot less problems now. But also things I handle them differently. When your bags get broken, I used to be in there like stirring shit up in my freezer,
looking for something and just toss it out of the way.
Your bags up. He goes on to have one more question. He's saying on a chamber sealer, do you still have to let it cool? Like during heavy use. Yep. You still got to let it cool off now and then. I have that. The main one I run is that Weston Pro 2300, which is like a beast. And yeah, you can burn it. You can burn it out too hot. If you're just going on it. You got to just let it chill out now and then. You can just tell. I just put my hand on it. I can tell when it's too hot.
I use the Food Saver vacuum sealer and it cuts you off. It turns itself off.
That's a real machine there.
Oh, yeah. Run some critters through that one. It just turns itself off.
It does when it gets hot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably smart for
self-regulating.
All right, Yanni. What do you got? I got a bunch more.
Along the same lines, I didn't get a name with this one. Brody didn't put in the names.
I don't tell their names. unless they want.
But Pete from Bozeman might be excited when we say Pete from Bozeman asked.
This Pete right here? You've been emailing in, Pete?
I got some questions for you boys.
He's saying that he's noticing that in a lot of the recipes, the pictures in the books, in the meat in the videos, he's saying that the meat always appears to be real fresh. Well, that's because we don't actually kill any of that stuff. We just go and buy it at the grocery store. No, I'm kidding there. But he was saying that he ran into the problem with ossobuco that he went and aged his meat, and then he wanted to use his shank, but it had like a rind on it. And the pictures and the videos he saw of us doing ossobuco, the shank didn't have this like hard rind on it. So he's saying, like, how do I get around that? Should I trim the rind? Should I not age it? Do I treat different cuts differently?
I'd say it depends on how heavy duty. You're asking me?
Anybody.
I'll go last.
All of you.
Why is he aging it to begin with? I mean, if you're making ossobuco out of shank.
Well, yeah, I'm guessing he just didn't know. No, yeah, that's what I'm thinking too. Is that it's going to be slow and low anyways? And
yeah, you're so cook you it. Don't you he don't need to do
really
that.
Need to be aged.
But that's let's say he's aging the whole damn deer.
Yeah,
because you're not going to like age some and not age the rest. So mm-hmm. He ages the whole damn deer.
Mm-hmm. And this is for quartered out, so you don't have the protection of the hide.
Yeah, I think unless you like wrap it in plastic, the rind is completely unavoidable.
Yeah, so what would you do with the rind then if you're going to ossobuco?
I think you got to carve it off.
What if you just cook it? Is it still going to, I don't know, I guess I've never cooked one with the rind on it.
Well,
the new rind experiment.
Is tough on a shank. I mean, I would tend to not let that age too long. I like aging the rest of it, but I you try picking that stuff off the shanks, it's just a pain
well, by
in
the time
ass.
You get it all off, you're down to nothing anyway.
You want to know a hot tip? Not related to this? Dude, you ever notice when you hang, if you're aging a deer, you hang up a deer, that the tenderloins are so small on a deer that if you like age it for a week, they get dried out where they're like, damn, they're kind of gone. Like it's all rind.
Mm-hmm.
Our buddy Steve Kendrot takes a piece of plastic wrap.
Yeah.
And when he's hanging the deer, he just pastes the piece of plastic wrap over the tenderloins. And then they don't get the problem that this boy's talking about. My take in terms of the shanks, you're cooking the sons of bitches so long that you're turning tendons into gelatin. I don't think
the rind is going to
in the end
have a chance.
But in a rind sense, yeah. Like when you've aged something good, like you pull the back strap off on a thing where it's been aged, yeah, I'm cutting that stuff away. But on that preparation, it has to be a pretty healthy. Like a big, thick, moldy rind I would cut off. But like any normal rind that I've encountered in my life, I feel like it's going to succumb. I feel like it's going to succumb to the cooking.
To the slow and low.
Right? Because I can't think of ever. Because there you're dealing with such a small thing anyway. Like the more you start fiddle farting around, trimming stuff off, you kind of are getting rid of the whole point. Like the beauty of the thing is you wind up with a bone that could go into a museum. You know, you're getting it like every last usable scrap off that thing. And that's kind of like what makes that dish cool. So I would have a hard time trimming parts of it off because then you're kind of like, you're negating the main point.
So our answer is if you're going to hang it for a while, take some saran wrap and wrap your shanks or cut the shanks off and get them in the freezer immediately.
Yeah, well, and do a Steve Kendrot on the tenderloins. Sorry, John?
Or just ignore it. You're saying just ignore it. Just cook it with the rind.
Any normal rind. How thick? I wish I knew how to describe stuff in mills. Okay, if you had a rind, I would say most rinds are about as thick as if you cut for instance, a paper coffee cup. If you went down to the local coffee shop and got a coffee cup, a normal rind is about like that paper. Fair?
Yeah.
I think that's on the light end.
Light end?
The actual rind, yeah, I would agree with that.
It's heavier.
There's like a purpley transition into the meat after that, but the actual rind that you have to carve away is probably about the size of a cup.
And I've seen some leathery-ass rinds, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like your average deer skin, that's how much you're going to end up carving off.
Yeah. So it just depends, man. If you know what? I don't know. It's hard for me to picture trimming that thing off. That's the last word I got to say about it.
I'm with you. All right. Here's another one. Everyone's going to have a tip for this guy. Padding. So just keep it to one because I know everybody's got one for this. He hunts by himself, and he's often not going into areas and not going deep because in archery season, he's worried he's going to kill something and not be able to get the meat out before it spoils.
I like this guy.
So what tips, tricks do you guys have to get the meat out faster or keep it cool longer? And as a general rule, how much time do you feel you have before the meat starts to spoil?
A lot of variables.
A lot of variables.
So read it again.
What tips, tricks do you guys have to either get the meat out faster or keep it cool longer? And as a general rule, how much time do you feel you have before the meat starts to spoil?
And we got a limit to like a simple trick.
And we're going to assume he's hunting elk.
Yeah, because he's worried about getting it all out. Because, yeah, if it was a deer, he'd pack it out in one shot.
Okay.
So it's something bigger than a single trip, maybe. Or who knows? A lot of people aren't going to want to carry a whole deer.
Okay.
You kill a big whitetail buck, 180 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to strip it down, but you know, a lot of people aren't going to want to do that.
No, that's a heavy load.
Yeah, some old dude, retired.
I don't think we can really answer the general rule on how much time do you think you have.
Well, okay.
Because there's just too many variables.
Sure, but I haven't thought about it.
If we can say at 50 degrees, then sure, I'll give you a number.
I'll say this, longer than you think, if the proper steps are taken. Longer. It's amazing how durable that stuff is if the proper steps are taken.
It's also amazing the temperature difference between a sun-filled meadow in early September and a dark, shady patch of timber
with a creek flowing through it.
Yeah.
Is that going to be your tip for padding?
Well, I'm just getting into this, but yeah.
You only get one tip or trick.
Yeah, okay. My tip is work quick and get that shit in the timber.
North facing slope.
Yeah. Hang it up. Good airflow. It just worked quick. Because, yeah, I've killed elk on hot September days before. And it is. You stick your hands inside that animal, and it's 100-plus degrees, and you pull your hands out, and it's 90-plus degrees outside. The clock is ticking. And so, yeah, working quick.
And think about taking a nap. Cold-ass day, and you're trying to take a nap down the timber, you got to go up into a sunny meadow.
Yep.
Or, conversely, you're trying to take a nap up in a sunny meadow, and you can't. No way.
No, too hot.
And then you go down, and you got to add a layer to take a nap down below.
Big difference.
That's by moving 50 yards.
Nature's refrigerator.
Phil?
I would say definitely get the hide off, and if you're super worried about it, get the bones out. You know, you get more airflow circulation into the big cuts of meat, like let's say it's an elk. You know, taking that hind quarter and getting it to where that bone is out of there. And also taking the hide off. That mountain goat I killed last year, we left the last hind quarter in the hide. I did a full body mount, and I was like, well, it's in the hide. I'm just going to leave it in the hide and pack the rest of this out. And we got out, and that hind quarter was still warm from being insulated from that hide, from that fur. Yeah. So hide off. If you're really worried about it, bone out.
Steve Areno?
That was my tip. I'm answering the part of his thing, like how long can you put it off? You can put it off a long time if you get the body heat out and you keep it in the shade, up in the breeze, not wrapped up in garbage bags, longer than you think, to the point where you're kind of surprised.
Days.
Yeah, the thing I always return to, man, we were hunting doll sheep once in Alaska, and it was no joke. There were so many fires. It was still fire season. There were so many fires going on that it was obstructing our glassing, like that kind of weather, and unseasonably hot in the 80s every day. And we killed two sheep. The first one we killed, I think we carried it around with us for 7 days. By being very judicious about how we were taking care of it, what we were doing that night. We'd even chisel a hole down in a glacier and get a good chill on it like that, but just moving it along and always trying to decide what best to do, hanging it by the creek, keeping it in the shade during the daytime, getting it out at night, letting it cool. And it was, I kind of came away with that with like a real appreciation for if you're properly equipped and paying attention, that you can do some pretty miraculous stuff without having meat spoil. And I've also had experiences, particularly when I first got involved in Western hunting, I had some experiences where I was shocked at how badly, how quickly something could go south. How just stunningly fast you could spoil something by not
letting it ride around the back of your pickup,
not dealing with the body heat.
Well, even in the
body heat,
even in the field, especially with elk, you know, I see it all the time. In rifle season, it's a cold day. There's snow on the ground, and guys will wait, you know, to field dress their elk, and that elk meat goes bad so fast, it's unbelievable.
Even in the snow,
if you don't get the neck opened up and get the esophagus out, get it breathing, you know, that you'll lose meat even when it's cold.
Yeah, because the thing's laying there 600 pounds. It's like, to get down into the core of it, it's what, 18 inches deep?
It's a heat factory, you know.
And that thing's 103 degrees internal body temperature or whatever.
Here's a question for you, Steve. Have you ever put meat in the crick?
You know what's funny?
Would you take a quarter and put it in the crick?
I had a question from a guy like that. And on that same trip I'm talking about, we had some contractor bags. And we were putting sheet meat in contractor bags and putting it down in a creek to cool it off underwater. The problem is dry bags, contractor bags, all this stuff is like pretty waterproof, but you submerge, you put it underwater. I don't know how it happens. The seams, I don't know what it is.
Yep.
Even like a brand spickety new contractor bag, somehow you open it up. Like, I don't know how it happened. There's a quart of water laying in the bottom of that damn bag.
So what's the danger there?
It just gets nothing, really. It's unsightly, and it turns all white and weird looking. But you know what? When I was hunting in Hawaii, I was hunting with some Hawaiians in Hawaii. The first thing they do is the first thing they do is bone out. We're hunting axis deer, bone the thing out and throw it into ice water.
Yep. What if you just took a
looks like a drowned rat in there, man.
Elk hindquarter hide on and just dunked it in the creek.
It would certainly protect one side.
Yeah. I would do that before I let it rot.
We're not talking about like Giardia, like laying eggs into your elk meat.
No,
it's like just, that's not happening.
It's just the discoloration and the way it looks once it's wet.
And the Hawaiians are like, they put it in the water to do what I'm talking about, is they put it in the water to draw the blood out.
Yeah.
They pull that meat out, it's like ivory. But dude, it was good, man. Then they steamed it underground.
Clayton or Saunders made jerky also like to do that.
He likes to chill in ice water.
For days.
I shot a black bear in the bear tooths a couple years ago, and it took me 2.5 days to get it out. And two nights in a row, we put all the bear meat in several trash bags and then into a creek.
Oh, there you go.
And so that was our refrigerator. The second morning, as I pulled the bags out of the creek, a pod of otters came past our camp, our creekside camp, that I'm sure smelled this meat. Miles and miles down this creek. Yeah, they came off the still water and came up into this tributary way, way up into the bear tooths. Saw a pod of otters. And I'm sure my bear meat had baited them up there. And it wasn't 5 minutes until I that morning pulled it out, and then
here they come.
10 squeaky otters slipped past camp. Like, they definitely would have ripped that bag up and taken all the meat.
Yeah, no doubt.
John, are there any tips or tricks left?
Well, I think the point about getting the meat off the bone, if you're really concerned, that's a big one. And getting airflow under it, any kind of airflow. You know, we did this on a moose hunt earlier this year. It was a DIY drop camp, and it was hot. And, you know, and it was just kind of rainy and warm the whole time, and so we were pretty concerned about the meat. But we got enough airflow on it and would flip them around every now and then. And we were out there for over a week and a half. And even though it smelled kind of ripe, when we actually got it back and started trimming it up, it was great.
Yeah.
So that is one of the things, to your point, Steve, that it's amazing how long, if you do care for it, it'll last.
But, you know, it seems like it's increasingly an issue in some ways. You know, I was in elk camp in September this year, a ways in public land, and was fortunate to have been able to ride into camp. But more and more, especially, you know, a lot of young athletic hunters, which is obviously great for the whole sport, but are sort of going solo, going in deep, you know, and particularly bow hunting elk, you know, you really have to think through.
What's your plan?
What is your plan? Because The one word answer I was going to give to the Pete from Bozeman, right?
Mm-hmm.
would be buddies.
Yes.
That's yeah. good.
Because, you know, you can get a signal on top of a lot of ridges. You can have a plan. Even if you want to hunt alone, I get that. I like to hunt alone too. But, you know, to be able to say, hey, I need some help.
Yep.
Get in here.
That was going to be my tip. And since you already had one, I'm going to just add on to that one. But, yeah, when I was talking about it yesterday, because I was hunting with my neighbor, and we got lucky, killed one, we're packing one out, and we're going through the same scenario. But living in Colorado, I had probably almost a dozen people on a list that it was just on the bulletin board year-round. But, like, my wife knew I would probably call her first and then be like, hey, run the list and get up here as fast as you can. Most of those people weren't hunters. Most of them were just people that liked, enjoyed the outdoors, were stoked to get, you know, a few steaks.
That's a good
point. Steaks and burgers. Yeah.
They want to hike, you know?
Exactly. They're like, sweet, so stoked to go for a hike today. Didn't have anything to do on a Sunday, you know? So
often it's hard to talk your hunting buddies into coming to help right? you. It's usually easier to talk to the guy that's like, I can get some elk meat. I'm, yeah. like, I'm coming.
And yeah. then you don't have to be shown another hunter your spot.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, it doesn't leave a lot to the imagination when you got to take him right to the exact spot you killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so here he is.
I might not have pinned this. Here's
exactly where he was standing.
Drop a couple of weight
but
points
I have a,
here.
I have a friend in Bozeman who they raise horses and they're raising pack horses, and he tells me every year, he's like, you know, the more experience these horses have getting them out, you know, let me know. So I take my DeLorean with me,
nice.
And he's just ready to go at all times. He does hunt too, but like he knows, he's just like, he'll be at work. You hit him with the DeLorean. He's just like, I got to go.
Nice.
He goes and gets his horse and we'll, you know, head up to the trail. So if you know or can get a hold of somebody that would do that kind of thing, because I know some, like way back before it became super popular, Cameron Haynes in his book would write about, he had a guy on call. He paid to pack his bulls out of the backcountry. And like you were saying, it's getting to the point where guys are, you know, so gung-ho to go the furthest, go, you know, solo that they don't even think about it. And then they get a bull on the ground. It's like, now what am I going to do?
Yeah. Now it's a big, big, big deal. I love my horse and my mule almost to an indecent level. But I'm not a great horseman by any means. You know, there's a lot of really great horse people around. And mm-hmm. There's sort of a question in my mind whether you should call a licensed outfitter for that job. You know, I get the friend and buddy thing with, mm-hmm. with horses and stuff, but in my mind, I'm wondering if there might be some rules and regulations about it. You know, there's lots of great licensed outfitters mm-hmm. in the state who would.
What would that cost?
I don't think it's real expensive relative to the service you're getting. You know.
What did that do in Washington? Did you ever talk about prices with him?
I never know.
That's what he does. He does that in the fall for a living.
Nice. It's like an Uber driver for
What do you think, John? $500 to pack out an elk 5 miles?
I think you could probably get an outfitter. It's sort of a wrangler to me, you know, someone
right.
who's really kind of just coming to help pack meat.
It's going to be him and another horse.
It depends, you know, how far, if it's 15 miles or 5 miles or what. But $250.
Oh, a
couple $100.
Is that right?
There you go. Save an extra $250.
That's a wild ass guess, but
and I've seen even in like diners and in Colorado, elsewhere, like you'll see a guy like with a sign up where you know like where you got, the guys like cut the buckskin on the end of a piece of paper,
yeah, taking
cut the fringe, you tear the tab off, and dude's advertising that service. That's a good thing to look into, man. Just have like an ace in the hole before you go hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to zap him with a question. This guy is from the UK, does not hunt, wants to know this. Could a major league pitcher with a wicked fastball, if taught to stalk a white-tailed deer, be able to kill the deer with a rock that could fit in his hand?
Oh.
And if he had a tag, would his methods for filling the tag be legal? That's a two-part answer, yes and no. Yes and no.
I think my answer is yes and no. Yeah, you probably could kill the deer. No, it's probably not legal.
Not legal method of take. Method of take is interesting. The level of specificity they get into on method of take, particularly if you get into something like waterfowl, where it's like shot size, composition of shot. So it's like how the diameter of the shot, what the shot is made of, the bore of the shotgun being prohibitions on too small, prohibitions on too large, how many shells the firearm can hold.
The gauge of the firearm.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Yeah. The gauge with the
bore size.
Bore yeah. size.
Okay. Right?
Like excruciating level of detail around method of take. And in some places, like Alaska, I mean, waterfowl is federal, but some places like there, they leave a lot. There's a lot of like open. They don't get into a lot of method of take discussions that other states get into.
What would be like the drastic end of that? Like coyote killing in Montana. Like, I don't know what would be illegal.
No, there's no method of take there. I don't think it's non-game.
Right? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yanni.
Got a couple good ones here. This one will be a little bit shorter, the least to answer, I think. This fellow's saying, well, it's Jordan, so it could be a gal.
Let's say it's a gal.
Okay. She's saying she's shot enough big game animals with a rifle that she knows what it looks like when she gets a good hit by the animal's reaction and behavior. And that so she can kind of tell like if it's a good hit and whether she has to shoot again or not. But even though it's a good hit and it's starting to get wobbly, it still is, you know, it's taking seconds to, you know, lay or fall down. So it's a little bit longer, but she feels like she's in a ethical quandary, wondering, should she just shoot again and get it over with, or should she just let it go on its own? And the reason it's a quandary for her is because she feels like a second shot might do more deep meat damage, and she wants to get as much good meat out of it as possible.
I like it. I like it.
Question. Good question.
I like it.
There's a reason guns hold more than one bullet. Because I've seen it, you know, any number of times. Guys think that they've knocked an animal down.
I know.
Even when it falls.
Even gals that have shot 100 critters.
Like Jordan.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I always put another round or two into the animal.
I disagree.
You do? Yeah. Oh, if it's standing, I'm shooting. If I've made contact, if I've wounded that animal, and now it is my responsibility to finish the job.
I know, but she's saying that like this is after a good shot. Like you it could be at 75 yards, and you saw the bullet go right through both lungs.
Yeah, I'm still shooting.
We're talking seconds. Probably just long enough to get off another shot or not.
I'm with Pete.
I'm shooting.
Keep shooting.
Put another one through the ribs.
John?
I think it depends on the animal.
That's what I'm saying.
There you go. Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Are we talking brown bear or are we talking white-tailed doe? Same thing. There's two different categories
here. It just depends, man.
I shot a brown bear in Alaska recently, and I'll leave some of the names out to protect the innocent, but it was a charge situation, and we emptied our guns. But it was kind of a life or death deal.
Yeah, that's its own thing.
Yeah, that's way different than...
You weren't going to wait a minute and see if it expires? I heard about that.
Yeah, it was kind of hairy. But then, you know, elk, deer, antelope, you know, plains game, you know, smaller stuff. Save the meat, Pete.
Yeah, I'm into it. I like breaking big animals down, though. I mean, elk are tough. Just because you think you have a fatal hit on them doesn't mean you do. I don't know.
I would say, yeah, depends on the animal. On a moose, absolutely.
Keep shooting them.
Yeah. On a moose, absolutely. On some stuff like whitetail or caribou, I would be like reading a lot into what I saw happen.
Sure.
Okay. What I thought was happening.
Now, it's interesting because Jordan really, and maybe I just didn't do a good enough job explaining this, but you guys have all answered it in sort of just like waste meat or not meat. She also is wondering about like the animal's misery in those 3 to 5 seconds.
But we're talking about fractions of, not fractions, we're talking about seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I think that any one of us, if they knew, if it was minutes,
shoot again.
By that point, there's no question anymore. Like, at probably 10 seconds, there's no question.
Yeah. If you have long enough to think about it, in my opinion, you probably should have another one going down.
Yeah, we're talking about something that we're talking about a decision that you're we're talking about a decision that's playing out over a handful of seconds.
You're talking about like dead on his feet, dead to rights. He's still dancing around, but he is 100% going to die. That doesn't sound like there's much of a reason to shoot again.
Yeah, if you get a hit on something, it runs 3 or 4 steps. You can see the shot place. It's like out clear. You can see the shot placement. You can tell from body language. You know, and it's going to be down within literally seconds. It's just not. I just feel like it's
you're not doing it a favor by shooting it again.
Especially if it's already kind of like dead while it's like dead while it's walking.
That's how I feel too. I feel like if I took a 30 cal through both lungs, I'm probably not feeling much else at that point. The world has gone fuzzy and gray, you know, immediately.
Right, and the reverse is so true. You know, it's what's worse than losing an animal that's been hit. So yeah. Sort of when in doubt, you know what I mean? When in doubt.
And that's kind of where I am. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you know that the animal's dead on its feet, okay, yeah, no need to shoot again. But, you know, it's the ones, especially those kind of marginal, like near the spine hits where they drop and everybody's starting to, you know, get excited and unload their gun and all that. Then all of a sudden the animal pops up and is off like a shot. Now you've got a mess on your hands.
Yeah.
That's why I'm always thinking about putting another one into it if I can.
You bow hunters might already know this. I'd be real curious to hear some opinions, but I learned from a buddy of mine, Jason Morrison, recently that, you know, on elk, you kill or you shoot a bull with an arrow, knock another arrow and shoot again. And maybe that's habit for you guys, but
there's nothing to lose then.
I think for a lot of guys, it's not. And, you know, if you're able to get a second arrow in an elk, it helps a lot.
Oh yeah. Oh, why not, man?
You know,
there's nothing to lose. Okay, ready for this one?
Please.
Is it okay to hunt squirrel on public land during deer hunting season? I know it's legal, but is it right? I know if I were going to hunt for 10 days for deer and a squirrel hunter came through, I'd be pissed. What's the etiquette on this topic? We've covered this before.
Huh.
I don't think you're under any obligation whatsoever to determine who has the rights to be in the woods. I just don't. Sucks for the deer hunter. Yes, it does. But it sucks for you more to stay home.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I think you could do a good turn. You pull up to a little parking area and a little game management area, and there's like a couple trucks there. It's getting toward dusk. You know, if possible, go another direction. But if it came to being that you feel like you need to sit home from October 1st to November 15th for fear of running into a bow hunter, no. No. It's your woods too, man.
Yeah.
Public landowner.
Yeah, it's just like, I'm sorry. I think you could do like, yeah.
If you want to be like, courteous if you're there. If you see the guy sitting in a tree stand, don't go stomping under him. Maybe, you know, try to sneak around or something. Yeah, but yeah, no reason you shouldn't be in the woods at that point.
If you know there's a bow hunter to the left, you could just as easily go right.
Go right.
That's just courtesy.
I killed a mountain goat right next to some ice climbers one time.
How'd they feel about that?
We didn't really actually have a conversation, but.
The sheet of ice cracked and they fell to their death.
They weren't able to talk afterwards.
They weren't responding afterwards.
They were not responding.
Oh, I think that was like a shared. That was an interesting combination of food. Yeah. Ice climbers and mountain goat hunters.
Oh. What's your take on that one, Yanni?
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. You know, if it's prime time, don't go in there. But go hunt in the middle of the day. But yeah, if it's going to keep you at home, I'd go into the woods and go squirrel hunting. Or hiking for that matter, or rabbit hunting, or maybe, I don't know, whatever it might be in the woods during, you know, deer season.
I just hate the idea that a small game hunter would feel like a second-class citizen in the hunting community. We need more small game hunters. Squirrel hunting's cool. Rabbit hunting's cool. You know, that's as legit as anything else we do. So I'm with you. Get out there.
But I do think that bow hunters think that their activities would trump others. Right?
That's a can of worms, but yeah. I mean, there is that attitude.
Because they're so invested in it. They got so much time invested in it. Right? And it's like comes down to these like precise moments. And you've got like a ton of effort, working your ass off, practicing, hanging stands. It's like, you know, waiting for the perfect moment, and then it gets blown by some dude who, from all appearances, seems to be like kind of willy-nilly, low commitment, low barrier to entry, wandering through the woods, shooting off 22 shells and bullshit with his buddy, right? It's like, it can feel that way, but in the end, I think it's just not your place, man. It's like, yeah. Everyone has just the same right you have.
You got to do your best to respect all the stakeholders at the table. Like if you're a fly fisherman and some guy comes floating down the river in an inner tube drinking a Coors Light, he's having a good time too.
Mm-hmm.
But you may be trying to stick a big brown trout in a spot that he happened to float right over.
Yeah.
So. You know, this is kind of a tangent, though, to what you're talking about. A couple of the guys, one of my buddies in particular, he's a great hunter. You know, we hunt public a lot, and we'll encounter other guys. And one of the things I admire about him is that he doesn't let the presence of other hunters deter him at all when he sees them.
That's the eagle. The eagle's like that.
Yeah. You know, I think that when people feel that, like, that drop, that disheartening sense of, oh, my God, somebody just tromped through my space, or I encountered a guy in my honey hole.
It's impossible not to feel right. It a little bit.
But I think a good hunter just is like, all right, I'm going to.
Well, it's like when I go bear hunting in the spring, there's always dudes around, and you know, you can get real down on it, or you can just be like, that guy's got no game. He ain't going to see the bears that I'm going to see.
Yep.
And I've been on Vantage where I come back from a stalk or something, and there's a bunch of guys just looking around willy-nilly, and they didn't see any of the bears.
There's,
you know?
Like karma.
God, that must have changed, man, because when I was living here previously, fucking no one.
There's a lot more bear hunters now. Oh, man.
It's a popular thing to do.
Yeah. It used to be something fun to do in the spring that nobody did.
No one.
I know so many bear hunters. It's kind of ridiculous.
Careful what you talk about.
They got spring fever.
Careful what you talk about.
Just on that topic about there's sort of karma to the sharing public land thing, too. We were in public land hunting and 2 years ago in September. And had a nice hunt on a good bull. Didn't quite happen. Excited to go back the next day. Alarm goes off at 4:30. And, you know, making coffee, getting boots on. And here come two public hunters. Said, you know, right through camp. Saying, we watched your elk hunt yesterday. Do you mind if I go try to get that bull that you did?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, yeah. It's, you know, it's your land too, man. Go for it.
You want to hear ballsy.
You want to hear a good segue?
I've never heard of that before.
You know, you're saying that your alarm went off. Here's a good segue. Check this out.
All right.
A guy wrote in about his buddy. We're talking about what makes turkey shot gobble, all the sounds that'll make turkey shot gobble. He said one day his buddy pulls out to a turkey hunting spot and he got there a little early and he's thinking he'll take a quick nap, but falls real asleep. And wakes up and it's already legal light. And he's so flustered and frantic to get out that he like messes up his keys and what he's doing and sets his own car alarm off. And his car alarm is going crazy. And a gobbler just 60 yards from his truck starts just hammering on the thing, gets the alarm off, goes down the trail 20 yards, calls that gobbler and gets him.
That's awesome.
Well, what else you got, Yanni?
Add that to the list, huh?
It was already on the list.
Oh, of things that make gobblers gobble?
The best one I've heard lately about, because I have a long list going of noises that make turkeys gobble, and the best one I've heard in a long time is the guy was saying the morning bells at a monastery. When he taunts turkeys near a monastery, and in the morning go, dong, dong, and the gobblers start hammering.
You could do the same thing with bulls bugling in late September.
Yeah, we had a guy say he didn't want me to say this because he doesn't want to blow it. He's like, don't tell anybody this. He hunts in Idaho, and he brings his elk bugle out in the spring to shot gobble turkeys. He said, holy shit, does it work good.
Huh. Oh, yeah, Will Primos, I think, has been doing
that. Oh, Will Primos knows about that? Yeah. Oh.
Nice.
I blow a rabbit distress call, and that works up a gobble.
Oh, that's funny. I've clapped real hard before and gotten to shot gobble at it.
Yeah, my brother
goes, whistle a big rip and whistle too.
My brother goes, "Hey!"
Speaking of hunting on public land, this fella found himself a sweet spot over, hunting over two scrapes. He was all pumped up, got his tree stand in there, got in early, and right at first light, he catches movement out of the corner of his eye.
Big old buck.
No, it is not a big old buck coming down the trail. It's another hunter.
It's a big old dude.
Who has a stand that he didn't see about 75 yards away from him. He whistles. He gets his attention. The dude waves back and
climbs in the stand.
Climbs in the stand. So he's not really worried about like the ethics or like what you should do, but he's worried about like the what's the associated hunting danger or danger that surrounds that hunting so close to another hunter that you don't know. You don't know what he's going to do.
Are there any dangers? None if he knows you're there.
Knows you're a human being sitting 75 yards away.
Well, unless he's just an idiot.
Right.
It's more dangerous than being by yourself.
Maybe. Unless if you fall out of your stand, at least he's there to see you. Give you a hand.
No
dangers?
That's a silver lining.
I say no dangers.
If I fall out of my stand, I got a buddy here to help me.
Did he say if he was rifle or bow hunting?
It didn't say. Well, no, it did. Bow season.
Bow season.
Yeah.
I'm a lot more worried about the guy who doesn't see me.
Yeah.
That's very true.
For sure, man. Yeah, it's annoying, but I just wouldn't like when I'm out assessing danger, right? You should always be out assessing danger. And a guy comes up and we acknowledge each other's presence and he decides to hunt 75 yards away from me. I'm not being like, ooh, this is getting dangerous. I'm like, this is getting extremely annoying. Not dangerous, but extremely annoying. Have we talked about the story we heard from Maryland on the show?
Yes.
We talked about that?
I think we did on the Maryland show.
You sure?
Pretty sure.
Dude, I wish I knew for absolute positive because it's the best story I've ever heard. The best hunting story I've ever heard.
Go ahead and tell it again. They won't mind.
So, buddy of ours down in Maryland is out in a marsh in a heavily hunted area. And they're hunting these little islands of trees out in the swamp, okay, out in the marsh. He gets up bright and squirrely, gets out in his thing way before light, and gets set up in his little island. And these islands of timber can be pretty small. You know, it's like 10 trees or whatever make this little island of timber. And he gets set up, and sure enough, toward light, here's the headlamp coming. He's like, I don't know. The headlamp keeps coming and coming and coming and coming until it gets to his island of trees. And he's like, psst, buddy, hey. It says, hey, I'm hunting here, you know? And the guy's like, well, I already got my stand over. So they don't really clarify what he's going to do, but he acknowledges that he needs to go and do something with his stand. So the guy comes right behind him. How many yards was he away? 18?
Yeah, something like
that. He range-finded him.
Yeah.
He's in a tree 18 yards away. It might even be less than that because you'll hear the rest of the story.
It might have been 17, but yeah.
So the guy starts pulling a chain. He's got it chained with like a heavy chain where he's like, as he's pulling the chain, you know, across the steel tree stand. He's like, oh my God, just get it over with, you know? And he thinks he's unchaining the stand to move away. But after a minute, sure enough, it's like the unmistakable sound of bark.
Climbing.
He's like, wick, wick, wick. And he's like, climbs up. I think it was 13 yards. The guy finally gets positioned, and he swings around his rangefinder, and rangefinders the guy, I think it was 13 yards away. As you'll see in a minute, how close they were. So he's looking out his side of the island, and the guy's 13 yards away looking out his side of the island. It's during muzzleloader season. So eventually it gets light out, and sure enough, blouch, out of this guy's tree. So our buddy like peers around to see what's going on. And there's a buck out in the marsh, clearly unscathed. And the guy is frantically trying to reload his muzzleloader, right, for a second shot. So our buddy swings around in his stand.
No, but the buck is also circling around.
Oh, yeah, the buck's what? Right,
don't make it sound like he's like now going to poach it. Yeah, the buck happens to run out walking, in front of him.
He's like not hit, right? But the guy's like frantically trying to reload his muzzleloader. So our buddy swings around and shoots the buck.
Perfect.
And the guy, they're so close, the guy whispers, "You got him." our buddy climbs down and goes to retrieve the buck, and he can't find it. And the guy who's sitting in the other tree stand has to direct him. He's like, "To the right, to the left."
So it worked out to his
advantage. Yeah, so he very says he got his deer, very quietly vacated the area. Oh,
the best part of the best part of the story is the whisper at the end.
You got him. You got him, man.
What else you got, Giannis?
This is probably a good one to finish up on. We're going to be about that time when everybody needs to go home for dinner. But this guy, William, asks, with all the hunts you do in bad weather, how does someone layer clothing on a budget? And
same way you layer it on a... Well, go
ahead. Yeah, but I think you can think of like a cheap way to get warm. And how do you keep your feet warm? Now, everybody's got a tip or trick for this guy. But think brevity, Phil.
I'm going long on this subject.
You want to go first? There's no other way for you.
I'm going long and deep.
Or do you want to pass it to John?
How to layer on a budget?
Mm-hmm.
Could get a job working for one of the camo companies. That would probably help. Well, here in Bozeman, if you go to the Goodwill, you'll find a lot of stuff that skiers drop off. They come for a week of skiing. My wife has all sorts of really nice, like, Patagonia pants and stuff from local Goodwill. She'd be surprised what people actually donate.
Any town, man.
Any town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to get tons of hunting clothes from the Goodwill in a town of 9,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It's called like St. Vincent's. It wasn't Goodwill, but same thing.
Yeah. I mean, don't overlook that kind of thing. You know, what you can find there. You know, it might not be the latest and the greatest, but, you know, if you're looking for base layers, you know, you don't have to be spending an arm and a leg to get them.
Right.
Also, I don't super believe in camo, so a lot of the stuff I wear hunting, you know, doesn't matter what color it is. So if it's like you go over and it's on a sales rack and it's at Bob Ward's, it's like, pick that up. Especially rifle hunting. You don't need to wear camo rifle hunting.
No.
Or bow hunting, in my opinion, but that's just me. So, yeah, look in the sales racks, look at the Goodwills.
Pete?
Well, I don't think there's much of a substitute for high-quality gear, but certainly before I had nice stuff, say, you know, like a $300 down jacket, which is an incredible piece of insulation. I think, like, in my college days, I was wearing a lot of, like, L.L. Bean fleeces and stuff like that, like layering cheaper garments that maybe more fleece-like than high-end treated down, and utilizing that kind of stuff and always stayed warm. Same with gloves. Like my best cold weather gloves are $14 at Murdoch's. They're leather mittens, and I buy a pair or two a year. They're the most like warm.
Big chopper mitt.
Yeah, you say that.
Those are good.
Because I run the, I call them Kermit the Frog gloves, but those military surplus wool gloves.
Yep.
Every year, just anytime I can get a hold of them, I grab some of those because you can put them underneath other gloves. They're cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You can get them online for $10.
As far as keeping your feet warm, maybe having boots a half a size bigger than normal. That little bit of air around your toes.
Good makes one, Pete.
All the difference.
It's a good one.
It's going to be hard to beat.
I get so sick of this, man. People be like, I wish I had enough money to go hunting. It's like, come on. I hunted and lived like comfortably for a long time as a magazine writer, far below federal poverty level. It's like nothing I always knew. The first doll sheep hunt I went on, I swear to God, I had a pair of boots I bought at Circle Square Pawn Shop, full-on army surplus rainwear. I had a wool shirt that I had coming into somewhere and took a pair of pants and cut out material to sew on big pockets onto my shirt with a needle and dental floss.
Nice.
We go out in the woods with rags, man.
Yep.
On that trip, my brother was wearing underwear he found in a shopping cart in the alley behind his house.
Which brother?
I'm not joking. Because he later had to cut them up to make bandages, and that got us talking about where he got them in the first place. And he found them in a shopping cart.
Yikes.
It's like, come on. It's having great stuff is really nice because it frees your mind up to do other stuff. It is. It's more comfortable. It's more pleasurable. It's better. But if it comes down to, if it, no joke, comes down to you staying home or like going or not going, and you're going or not going based on whether you have like good technical apparel, you're never going to be anything. You're never going to be anything, and you're never going to be happy.
It's tough love, man.
It's just like, listen, it's true. If it's like, oh, I can't go because I don't have, like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
How bad do you want it?
I was in my 30s before I had a rifle that wasn't a hand-me-down rifle. It's like, give me a break. I'm left-handed. I shot right-handed rifles till I was in my 30s. Man. When I got a left-handed rifle, I couldn't even figure out how to use it. It's just like, if that's like really keeping you out of the woods, but yeah. That's not even answering his question.
There's always a reason
the same
not
principle.
To go.
It's like, go down, find every used store, every Goodwill, Salvation Army, St. Vincent in your town, and every month drop in there and see what they got laying around.
Yeah.
And just make it your summer project. You'll outfit yourself, right? It might not be the best stuff, but it's functional.
It might be awesome stuff. My wife's hunting pants are from a Goodwill that she found. It was just
nice.
You know, in a ski town, people drop it off because they'll never use it again.
Yeah.
You know, and she's got a high-end pair of pants that probably retail for $200 that she got for $20.
Yeah. And I would, in all fairness, all the time I was doing that, dude, I was totally lusting after like really bomber great apparel. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the difference between going and not going. And you can go and be comfortable, and you can be wishing and dreaming about getting some sweeter stuff. But you just got to, at a point, you just got to decide you're just going to go. And then figure the rest out. Keeping your toes warm. Yeah, have a little bit bigger. If you got some old pawn shop boots, put some snow seal on them. Use toe warmers, like those little, what do you call them?
Hand warmers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hand warmers for your toes. Those things are great.
Mm-hmm.
And go out and, you know, go after hunting season down to your local sporting goods store, and you're usually giving those things away because they don't last forever.
Good one.
The other thing about your feet is it's moisture management is such a huge deal, you know? And if everything's working properly and you're in a situation where you're hiking and ascending, you're perspiring. Your whole body's perspiring. And something I tell a lot of guys is, you know, layering is great, but you got to actually layer. You know, when you're about to ascend, it could be very, very cold.
Oh, like use your layers.
Use your layers, you know. Take your coat off and put it in your pack. And
The hardest thing to do.
Strip down, you know. And you're only going to be chilly just for a second, and then you're going to be hot and sweating. Well, all that sweat goes to your feet. And so managing moisture, managing perspiration inside your
boots. Hold on. When you're saying all that moisture goes to your feet, you're saying that, like, dripping down your legs goes
well,
to your
you
feet?
Know, I'm being figurative a little bit.
You get hot, but your feet sweat.
But your feet are sweating too.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, I had a situation one time where a guy said, hey, I just got these boots and they're giving me trouble. I can't stay warm. And I started talking to him, and he worked as a security guy in a mountain town. And he said, yeah, you know, I get dressed. And I said, well, wait, hang on a sec. How far is your drive to work? He says, yeah, it's about an hour, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. I'm like, dude, how hot's your car?
Smoking.
You know, it's 20 below zero outside. It's 75 degrees in your car.
Sweaty feet.
And by the time you get there, your feet are sweating.
Yeah. You know? I have a friend who cat hunts who does a he won't blow hot air on his feet, and he won't put his boots on till he gets there, and he keeps his boots in the back so his feet don't get oversweated before he gets out and actually goes hiking.
Exactly.
So or even
putting on cold boots on purpose.
Yes.
Yeah. Huh.
We're not necessarily because, you know, he's just trying to keep his feet dry the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, packing an extra pair of socks, and when you do get sweated up, take the time to take them off, get your feet aired out, put on fresh socks. You put on a fresh pair of dry socks and your feet feel like $1 million. Yeah.
It's like you just treated yourself to a day at the spa. It's unbelievable.
Put them back.
Throwing a pair of socks in your pack is a great tip.
Yeah, that's good.
It sucks last, man, because you guys keep stealing my stuff.
I got more to add. We were running mountain lions with a guy, and it was no joke. It was 13 below zero. He had uninsulated leather boots. He goes, I got sweaty feet. I do better all day, I do better to keep my feet warm with uninsulated boots because the minute I start doing anything, they sweat up.
I do that same thing.
And when we're out working, it's a real thing. When you start out in the morning, it's a real thing with like having the discipline and having everybody get on board to have the discipline to strip down before you hike.
Oh yeah,
because people want to start and then 5 minutes in, someone's got oh, I gotta shed a layer. Then like 5 minutes later, someone else is gonna shed later.
And they're already sweating.
And I don't have the best discipline. Like I screw this up too. But like if you're smart, you're stripped down and you're waiting for everybody to put their pack on. Shivering. You're doing push-ups.
Yeah, trying to stay warm.
Because you're like, I just gotta keep warm until we get going. That's the person that winds up winning. But it requires so much discipline. I still, all these years later, I still am always getting to the top of some hill sweating my ass off because I was too lazy.
Yeah.
I was too lazy to do what I know I should have done. And then you're up there, and then you want to talk about cold. Then you're kind of cold. It's hard to recover from.
Yeah.
Trying to get soaking that. Wet, windy, sitting still cold.
Exactly.
It's different than the chilly getting ready to walk cold. That's a killer cold.
Yeah. And you try to manage it, but you know how it is. Sometimes you're in a hurry. You're fighting. You know, you want to get there before the sun comes up, and so you're jamming, and you're just sweat.
Some of these fights you're not going to win. These are just things you have to learn to deal with.
Yeah, there's sometimes you're just going to be a sweaty mess.
Just going to be cold and sweaty.
But man, when I was a little kid, my dad pounded it. For him, it was scent control.
Hmm.
But like walking so slow out to your tree stand and carrying your clothes with you and always staying cold, staying chilly, you know, and then putting your clothes on because he was always worried about that perspiration and deer smelling you. I want to talk about full circle. Remember we started talking about that a long time ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys are afraid to be cold. It's okay to be cold a little bit. I mean, there is that. Like you said, after you've done the hike and you're in the wind and stuff and that kind of full body tremor type stuff, that sucks. But just general cold, your feet being a little cold, your hands being a little cold, there's nothing wrong with it.
Makes being warm a lot cooler.
Feet being cold is no fun.
We're going to find out how good Yanni is because if he can still come up with some original material,
yeah.
We'll see how good he is.
You guys couldn't see that, but I just cracked my knuckles. Is that what that's called?
Yeah, you did like a thing where you're like getting ready to.
Yeah, ready to go.
What I would have done about is I would have spit into my palms. Like in the old days when someone's going to use like a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Spit into your palms like you're getting ready to work.
Yeah, it's not totally original, but I think I can work off of the perspiration thing. And another thing that actually that same cat hunter that you were speaking of, Bruce, was doing, and that he was a real stickler on was, and we were day hunting. But the peats dryers, or however you can do it, but those boots, they hold some moisture from your feet, that sweat. Dry them out every night. Get that moisture completely out. That'll keep your feet warmer.
Pull your insoles.
That's the best you can do? Get a peats dryer? Come on.
No, it's saying when you're using your boots day in and day out, start them off dry.
Yeah.
Get that moisture out from the day before.
Hit me with another one. Come on. Dig deep.
Another one I've heard of, I can't say I've ever done.
He's going into hearsay now.
But I believe it works because it works around the whole having air inside your boot and having that zone of air insulation is having some sort of an insole. And then I've heard that people will actually take like, you know, the styrofoam that your ground meat comes in, will cut that out in the shape of an insole and put it underneath their insole to give another layer of air between them and the ground.
The stuff that the steak comes on?
Yeah.
You heard of that, John?
Yeah, that's not bad.
You like that?
Yeah, I do like that. Yeah. Yeah, I can't say I've tried it, but
start throwing in a little meat packing materials when you sell boots.
Hey, yeah. You know? Reuse.
Remember when you were a little kid and your mom would make
all
your
right,
mom
here
would,
you go. I got it. Okay, I'm just going to keep working down right through the sole of the boot. And so if you're standing around and you're getting cold feet, and this is a mountaineering trick.
Yeah.
You take your butt pad and lay it down and stand on it instead of the cold ground or the cold snow.
That's an ice fishing trick.
I just walk in circles. I'm dead serious. If I'm stationary at a glassing spot or whatever, and you're freezing cold and your feet turn into ice cubes, I'll just walk in a little circle and that, high step.
I always wondered what you were doing.
Yeah.
I thought Pete was lost.
See all that game running off that hill? See the deer
jumping. Somebody's lost again.
I'll give you another one.
You're on a roll.
When you're sitting there and you're on that glass and tent, you know you're not going to go hiking off for a little while. Loosen your boots up.
Yep.
Don't keep them cranked
Wiggle
down.
Wiggle your toes.
That's a good idea.
Leave some room in there.
I'll give you another one. If you really have a cold feet problem, they make over boots.
Hmm.
Yep.
And we met a dude. What's that store in Anchorage? Wiggy's?
Mm-hmm.
We met a dude who was saying, like, he had some over boots. You need a separate backpack to carry him around. But he was saying, like, you, like, actually cannot get cold with those over boots on. And mushers, you know, mushers use them. That's and guys, sweet. You know, on
he's 100 an interesting cat.
Oh, you know about that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that whole deal?
Yeah.
He is an interesting dude. Remember when you were a little kid and your mom would put those bread bags, like, line your boot with a bread bag to keep them waterproof? Mm-hmm. That's a good way to get cold.
Plastic bag right on your
foot. Oh, yeah, man, like the Wonder Bread sack. I remember, like, my mom, like, when everybody had moon boots, my mom sticking that bread bag down in there. I can't even remember why. Oof.
Well, it's like John was
saying.
Because
your moon boots weren't waterproof.
Yeah.
About being cold once in a while in bed. I remember learning how to duck hunt when I was a kid, you know, probably 8 years old or something, freezing, just miserable, you know. And how'd you, what was the lesson? Get down and shut up.
Yeah, I'm not so character worried about building. You keeping warm as I am about you keeping quiet.
Exactly.
Are we good, Yanni?
Yeah, I mean, we can keep going, but we've been at it almost 2 hours.
I'm good.
We can do some closing thoughts.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Anybody has any?
There you go.
Phil, John?
Right on us, man. Closer, John?
I was prepared for you guys to corner us with the hot tip thing, because that's
oh, we're going to do that later.
Listen, don't you worry.
That's coming.
We're doing a hot tip off, okay, and like as soon as we wrap this up, we're going to do two hot tip offs.
When that was coming.
We're doing a double hot tip off.
Very good. I got like six, so I'm ready to go.
Oh, nice. You now that you're going to take all my how to keep your feet warm.
Yeah, exactly.
I just gave you.
Yeah, if you want to, if you're interested in hot tip offs, well, hot tip off, this is my concluding thought, Yanni. If you're interested in what a hot tip off is like a bake off, except it's when you give hot tips. And if you go to the Meat Eater TV, what's the exact handle? I don't want to mess it up.
Instagram?
Yeah.
@MeatEaterTV.
Go to @MeatEaterTV on Instagram, and there we post hot tip offs where you get a room full of people or two people, and they have a hot tip off contest. Who's got the hottest hunting and fishing tip? Very popular. Mm-hmm. Hot tip offs. That's my concluder. Double concluder is buy the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook, recipes and techniques for every hunter and angler. Buy it now. It is released and out and ready for you. Pete, concluder?
Man, I hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving.
Sweet.
I'm really excited for Thanksgiving because I don't have to spend it alone hunting because I've
This just is going to air post-Thanksgiving, so you should say, I hope you had a wonderful
I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and still are very full from your bountiful meal you had with your family. And that's about it. Happy holiday season. Can't wait for the Christmas music.
Yeah, good.
Are you sure?
Oh, I love it.
I like that tune. I like that drummer boy tune.
What's your favorite?
You know, I'm a big sucker for Frank Sinatra. Christmas.
Oh, come on, really?
Yeah.
Oh my God!
You're saying you don't like
that man.
Oh, what?
Sinatra. My dad likes Sinatra. He's Italian. I'm like so little Italian. I don't even like him anymore. My dad liked him because he's just enough Italian to like him.
Rat Pack.
Oh, man. Just like he oversells all that. It's like come on. I'm a DC Berman from the Silver Jews, man. He said all my favorite singers couldn't sing.
Hmm.
That's why I'm a Petty man. Dylan, Petty, anyone that can't sing, I like.
Just the grunge.
Just getting it out.
Just let me
just
hear
get it,
it
out. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Sinatra didn't write any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's all
he
right.
He was an interpreter. Yeah. Come on.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
I'm trying to think of a good Sinatra tune.
Oh, there's too many.
Well, thanks for having me
Start
on.
Start spreading the news. Isn't that him? God, I didn't know I could sing that good.
That's good.
Start spreading the news.
Oh, no. Whole new career.
Phil, you were saying?
I was going to say thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It was fun to do. And, yeah, when your new bow shows up, hit me up and we'll...
Trick it out. We'll accessorize.
Trick it out and... Maybe work on what
form.
You
don't say. Yeah, form. Don't heard, say form.
No, your form's good. You were talking about your shot sequence, how you get in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of work I need to do, man.
We can get you in your head, so you'll be just.
I made a lot of mistakes this year.
Stone cold killer with that bow next year.
I made a lot of mistakes this year. I got a lot of work I need to do.
We'll get you hooked up.
Good. Thank you.
John or John?
Well, I hope everybody has a great holiday season as well and jumps right into predators. Mm-hmm. Now it's time for that to start picking up.
What about ice fishing?
One of my favorite times of year. Ice fishing's good too. I don't know.
Are you a hard water angler?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? So I hang out all winter?
Yes. So we drove by one of my favorite burbot spots the other day, and the whole thing.
Oh, we were talking about this.
Is glassed over right now.
With ice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it's only a matter of time before it's safe enough.
Take the truck. I got me a brand new 4-man Eskimo, and then I got me a brand new Ion Auger. That there ain't gonna be a lake when I get done with it. There ain't gonna be no ice. Ice is gonna be gone.
The whole thing. I'm
gonna drill the whole lake and then fish it on a boat.
Steve's gonna be out on a floating ice cube.
Actually, we did just make a resolution. Me and my son yesterday. We're gonna get a bunch of whitefish this winter. We're gonna do a bunch of whitefish cooking.
That's nice.
Good. Smoking whitefish,
crab cakes,
river mountain whitefish out of the river.
Yep.
Those kind of whitefish.
Yep. River whitefish. Great for bouillabaisse.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of stuff. So yeah, they'll be fishing.
Cool. Is that it? You got more?
No, that's it. I've got a bunch of hot shooting tips, but it looks like we're not going that
way. Just give us one right now. What the hell?
All right. Exposed windage caps on your turrets on your scope.
Tape them shut.
Tape them. Tape them. They have no business being there.
That's just windage. Tip. Just windage or elevation too.
just
windage.
Just quit screwing around with this stuff.
Now, aren't there a bunch of funny stories about guys hiking with non-zero stop elevation turrets, you know?
And
you
Oh, I've had it happen.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, just like spinning away, like left and back right and then left.
I got no idea where I am.
Best animal of your life. Talk about a buzzkill. Oh, my goodness.
Bye.
Concluding thoughts, John Edwards?
Get the cookbook. It's insane.
I like this one.
Man. Yeah, yeah. We had a super cool event the other night with these guys, and the cookbook's great. I'm going to try to read a recipe and put it into work. So that's kind of my thing.
But good. Thanks for having us at the place, man.
It was fun.
It was a great venue. It was a fun event.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve and Yanni both. I mean, you guys rocked the house. But, I mean, how long did you meet and greet? 3 hours? Four?
We were there until pretty late.
Yeah, it went long. But
2.5-ish.
Yeah. I meant to say, like, there were people who flew in from Missouri.
And Jersey.
To Montana. From Jersey. From Jersey was the farthest?
I think so. I heard Jersey, Oklahoma. Those are the two far ones.
You know what we ought to do, John, is we should do an annual holiday party, man, at Schnee's.
Like it.
That'd be fun. Yeah. We'd always have a reason. We don't have to worry about making up reasons all the time.
Like it.
Like cookbook launches. Just do it normal. Holiday.
And then we had this sort of super secret thing down the street at a little speakeasy. How'd that go?
That was, I've been talking it up.
Was it all right?
It was the best thing.
Oh, yeah. I feel like I have another regret in life now, and that was turning down that invite.
I don't know what the rules are here, so I want to name names or nothing, but it was pretty good.
Anything.
It was pretty
don't
good.
Don't ruin anything.
Yeah.
My concluding thought is, you guys don't even know about it. Steve does, though. But by the time this airs, if you have not heard about the new How to Gut a Deer Meat Eater Bandana, you've been living under a rock.
Huh.
If you haven't gotten one yet for a stocking stuffer, you're being naughty. Set your new friend, your new hunting buddies up. Set your old hunting buddies up. If they really know how to gut a deer, it'd be like a fun gag joke. Tell them they haven't really shot that many things. They might need a little refresher.
Talk about how you came up with the idea.
I came up with the idea. I think two ideas sort of collided. I was packing around a orange bandana that has a bunch of like emergency survival tips on it. I just always have a bandana in my rear pocket because my nose runs in cold weather, no matter how good I'm feeling, and I like to keep it clean.
It's not gang affiliated or anything?
No, it doesn't.
Just throwing gang signs.
It's not flopping out of my rear pocket, my left one. No, tightly tucked away. And so I had that, and then I think Garrett's girlfriend was out gutting a deer by herself and referencing pictures on her cell phone that she had taken of the big game guidebook.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And so she's sitting there in the field, cold. It actually was like a cold. I think it was 2 years ago. And we had like a really cold late November.
Yeah, and Dirt was hunting with some other dudes somewhere else.
That's right.
His girlfriend's hunting one area, and he's off in some whole other area hunting with mugs, hunting with his buddies. And she gets a deer.
She got a deer. So anyways, I heard that story, and I was looking at this bandana, and I was thinking, you know, it'd be a good idea to have instructions on how to gut a deer on a bandana that also has other uses, like blowing your nose, tying it onto an antler for extra safety when you're packing it out, flagging your friend. You and I are always flagging each other, especially in coos deer country with orange bandanas.
Tie it on a stick.
Yeah.
And be like, go right, go left.
That's right.
Plus fashion.
Fashion.
You know, make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Nelson, man.
Yeah.
Think about all that dude got done with a bandana tied around his head.
Yep. That's right. We haven't even mentioned that you could wear it as a headdress.
That's right.
Headpiece. So there you go. Go
I like
buy,
that Willie
buy
song.
A bandana.
I like that Willie song where he's trying to convince his lady. He's like, yeah, you know, I run around a lot, but I always come home to you. That doesn't go over well anymore.
Thank you for listening. Is that all right if I say it? I never get to say that.
Yeah, wrap her up.
All right. Thank you for listening.